You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The Supreme Allied Commander visited us at one time, and he basically said, what you guys are there for is to buy me time, to give the allies in Western Europe the time to set up to meet and engage the enemy.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. James Stayskal served for 23 years with US Special Forces, including two tours in Berlin. Special Forces Berlin was a small detachment of 100 highly trained soldiers who, should hostilities break out, were to wreak havoc behind Warsaw Pact lines. The US government only acknowledged its existence in 2014, and James has written an incredible story of how these unsung heroes would have fought and died on what was effectively a one-way mission. Now, if you can spare it, I'm asking listeners to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Plus, you get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a monthly financial supporter of the podcast. You bask in the warm glow of knowing you are helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Thanks to our latest Patreons, including Ian Krangle, Steve Minigar, Ryan King, Claudia Morgenstern, Mike Sir, Graham Randall, Ian Mackay Dahl, Mike Chapman, Michael O'Donnell, Robert Crom, and Jeffrey Jones. Don't forget, in this episode, we have a book giveaway of James's book, Special Forces Berlin. So make sure you listen through right to the end for details of how to enter. Back to today's episode. The story starts with James's initial recruitment into the US Army. We welcome James to our Cold War conversation.
I think the best way to put it is that my father recruited me into the Army. My father served in World War II in Europe, and I was always fascinated with the Army, you know, as a child, playing Army with the neighborhood kids. And he was active duty only during the war and during the Korean War. But every summer he would come home from summer camp and bring something back with him. And, you know, whether it was sea rations or patches from units he worked with, a training manual, something like that, he always dumped them on my bed. And one year he brought home a recruiting brochure for Special Forces. I believe this was like 1964-65, and it was one of these glossy brochures. I don't believe the Special Air Service has them over there, but we, of course, did. But it was a glossy brochure with pictures showing Special Forces soldiers in all kinds of environments with all the strange equipment they used, jumping out of airplanes, using Russian weapons. And that got me really intrigued. I was already very intrigued in things like Ian Fleming. I had read a lot of the books about the Office of Strategic Services, the Long Range Desert Groups, SOE, and things like that in World War II. So I was interested not so much in espionage per se, but unconventional warfare as it applied to the military. What Churchill would call his sort of dirty tricks boys. And that was what it was. I went to college, university, could not decide what I wanted to do, and then said, well, it's about about time that I joined the Army. And so I enlisted. So.
Right, right. And presumably you couldn't enlist straight into Special Forces. You were in like a regular unit to start with.
That's correct. I came in under the infantry rubric. I went to the 82nd Airborne Division, served with them for a while, and then managed fairly quickly to escape that place, which was a good thing. Right after Vietnam was not the best place to be in the regular Army, quite frankly. A lot of discipline problems, a lot of drug problems, and I said, I'd rather go over here. And I managed to pass the basic entry requirements and then tried out for the assessment and selection. So that was 1973.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I also read that you came across Detachment A on an exercise as well.
That is true. I was assigned to my first Special Forces unit was in the northeastern United States. It was 10th Special Forces Group, which specialized on the European operational area. And we used to do a couple of annual exercises in Europe. And my detachment, my team, parachuted into southern Germany. And we were basically working against a quote-unquote aggressor enemy force, which was one, I can't remember exactly one of the conventional infantry units in southern Germany. But one of the so-called underground people that was helping us was we would often see him. He was wearing civilian clothes. He spoke very good German. And I thought he was a German until I asked my team sergeant about him. And I came to learn that there was another small detachment of Special Forces people stationed in Berlin. And this guy was one of them. And from that moment on, I made it my mission to get to that unit. And I did about 4 years later.
Right. And what were the qualifications to be able to join that unit? Did they come and find you, or did you make it clear that's where you wanted to go?
I made it very clear to the people in the recruitment branch at in Washington that that's where I wanted to go. At that particular juncture, if you were in Special Forces, you were qualified to go to any of the Special Forces units, save perhaps the language qualification. So if you spoke Spanish, you would go to 7th Group in Panama or something like that. 10th Group had a lot of European targets. People spoke all the different languages. I, from the outset, strove to learn German, and that was the required language to get to Berlin. Obviously, you had to have a pretty good record. You couldn't have any strikes against you, but they were looking for German language, Special Forces qualified people. It was a small unit, only about 90 people, and of those, there were 6 11-man teams, so doing the mathematics, it was 66 people on the team, so it was a small unit.
Yeah, yeah. And what were the sort of people like in the unit itself?
Oh, it was, I'm not sure what the comparison would be, but it was a very interesting place to be. We've had a number of people that were born and bred Americans, but we also had a high percentage. About that time, it was about 25%. Before I got there, it was even higher, of Eastern European, what we called LAJAC people who had come to the United States and gotten their citizenship by serving in the military. We had quite a few of those. And we had a number of Germans, too. Germans who had come to the United States and decided to be a soldier and ended up going back. So we had, for example, we had a Polish merchant marine man who had jumped ship and joined the army. We had a commander who was a Czech resistance fighter during World War II. He had actually escaped Czechoslovakia and then gone to France and fought with the French resistance. The senior enlisted man was a German who at the end of the war, he was about 14, I believe, was a member of the German resistance organization called the Werewolves. But luckily, he saw the handwriting on the wall rather quickly and surrendered to the Americans. And once he found out what the Americans were like, he decided he wanted to go to the United States. So it was quite a place. It was quite interesting.
Wow, it sounds more like the French Foreign Legion than.
That's actually what the Lodge Act was referred to when it first started up in the 1950s. And the detachment, I think in 1960, it started in 1956, but Special Forces and the people in Bettholz, which was the other Special Forces unit in Europe, and Berlin, there were quite a few Eastern European emigres, and many of them made a lot of the interesting history in the unit. One guy was, he didn't serve in Berlin, but he was a Finnish soldier during World War II, a guy by the name of Lauri Torne, and actually won Finland's highest honor and ended up emigrating to the United States. And he was serving in Vietnam on a classified mission when he and his team actually disappeared. So a lot of interesting people.
Absolutely. And can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what the training consisted of for Detachment A?
Well,
you'd already gone through your special forces training, I guess.
Correct.
What other specialist training?
Well, The mission for the unit was not unlike the missions for the other Special Forces units. Although in Vietnam there was a switch to more counter-guerrilla fighting, the mission for Special Forces in Europe was basically unconventional warfare behind the lines. As we were in Berlin, already behind essentially the lines, we didn't have to worry so much about getting into where we were going to fight the war. That's where we were already. So we concentrated on being able to go underground and survive. And that meant we had to be able to not only have good field training, how to work in the woods, but how to survive in an urban environment. So we relied on the experts from the CIA. A lot of CIA officers came to Berlin to help us out, to instruct. Most of them were former Office of Strategic Service officers, and they would teach things like sabotage, intelligence tradecraft techniques, how to communicate in a secure manner in a city, things like recruitment of assets. We also worked on technical things like breaking and entering, how to pick locks, how to get into a building, how to counterfeit documents. It was a lot easier then. Some things that are fairly difficult today, we could do easily back then. But it was a very diverse kind of training schedule. We did all the hard skills, shooting, explosives, but had to also concentrate on things like being able to identify Soviet units, Soviet equipment, East German equipment, so that we could report back and tell the command structure exactly what we were seeing in our operational area. So
right. Right. And so did you have like your own legends, your own fake ID and safe houses and stuff like that?
We acquired safe houses. We had IDs. The agency helped us out with that. Each person developed an a cover story for what would fit his personality and his abilities and skills. We had people that were quite naturally, they spoke fluently Polish or Turkish. That would be become their identity. We had other people like me who would speak Greek, although I spoke German well. My German was not high enough. I couldn't fool an East German security officer, let's put it that way. But my Greek was at a level that I could speak Greek and pull that one off. So I had Greek documentation that was produced back in the United States. We did not use those on a daily basis. That was stuff that would come out during the wartime. We had that for our wartime mission. Right. When we were doing things during the peacetime mode, we would often use other identifications, and it would be either German or American identification. We were not always soldiers, let's put it that way.
Right. And I was going to come on to that, but can you just tell me a little bit about what your targets would have been? Because as I understand it, there were two units to remain in Berlin, and then the other four were supposed to cross the wall and attempt various missions in East Germany.
This is where it started to get into the question of suicidal mission or not. the units that were to stay inside Berlin had targets that would be kind of fixed targets, like power plants and things like that, that had to be knocked out to ensure the Soviets or the East Germans could not use them if they managed to get into the city. For the teams that went out outside the wall, the targets were in some cases more difficult and in some cases easier, but the main thing we were looking at was how do we slow down the Russian forces or the Soviet forces from moving west towards the Volga Gap. And that basically keyed in on the railway around Berlin. All the rail traffic from the Warsaw Pact, from East Germany, from Poland, and from the Soviet Union, the majority of it, not I said all, but the majority of it went around Berlin, what was called the Berliner Ring. So that was one of our primary targets. There were also some hard targets, the Russian command post, which was south of Berlin, the East German command post, which was north of Berlin. Those all became targets for us at one time.
How were you expected to take on a target like that? Because presumably it would have been guarded by thousands of Soviet troops, for example.
Well, we had the notion that most of these areas would not be as heavily defended during wartime as they would be during peacetime. If the Russians were in an offensive mode, most of their special units and heavy units would be moving forward. So a very small team would be able to infiltrate into an area and do as much damage as possible. I won't go into the specific methodologies, but there were some methodologies that would not require getting too close to the facility.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. You're going to leave it very enigmatic like that.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. No. That's fine. That's fine. No. That's really interesting. There. The other thing that I read is that I know you're probably going to hate me asking this question, but and you may not answer it anyway. But I've read that you did have some quite advanced gadgets in the team, almost James Bond-like.
Well, we had we had a lot of interesting individual equipment. And I think if you pick up an SOE training manual, a lot of the stuff that would show up in those manuals were similar to things that we had. Suppressed weapons, silenced weapons, specialty kind of explosives, miniature radios, not miniature, but compact radios. A lot of stuff that the regular Special Forces units did not have. We also got all the weapons that we carried were not American. They were either sterile weapons or they were Soviet bloc weapons. So we had the full gamut of interesting things to use. And then we had access to other things that would become available if necessary.
Yeah, no, I was surprised to see that, you know, that there was a photo, I think, in the book of somebody using a whirl rod, which was a British manufactured noise suppressed weapon from World War II, which appeared to be very vintage.
It was very vintage, and I've written a couple of articles about that weapon since then. But that weapon was originally built by Station 6 of the SOE, a 32 caliber weapon, and then they shipped one to the United States, and we decided we liked it. We also made them. We made a 9mm version. I think the British did also. But that weapon continued to be produced for quite a while, and my information is correct, the SAS had them in their inventory up until just after the Falklands War, or possibly the first Desert Storm. And my unit had, the unit in Berlin had them until at least 1990. So they were still, they were a favored weapon. It was, the well rod was a true suppressed weapon, silenced weapon, yeah. I should say. With a lot of suppressed weapons, you will hear the actual pop of a round going off. With the well rod, you could actually hear the hammer hitting the firing pin. You wouldn't hear the round going off. And it was not the fastest weapon to reload. It was more like a plumbing implement. you had to twist a knob on the rear end and then cycle it. And so to fire two rounds required about 3 seconds.
Right.
So you had to count on your first round doing what it needed to do.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, you know, I'm familiar with some of the special operations executive weapons that were used during World War II, and the example that sort of sprung here in the book was the explosives within lumps of coal.
Yeah, we had those. Interestingly enough, those would work for things like, by the 1970s, they would work for a thing like a coal-fired plant, power plant. They would not work on a coal locomotive because these Germans by that time were crushing all their coal and feeding it in as a powder, a more efficient method, and that ruined the effect there. So some of the things that we had became obsolete over time, and the coal was one of them, basically.
Right. And for the teams that were planning their attacks across the Berlin Wall, how were they making themselves familiar with their targets?
Berlin probably had the highest concentration of intelligence units anywhere in the world at that time, both Warsaw Pact and Allied. And one of the great things about being there is if you wanted to know who lived at a specific location in East Germany, you could pick up a phone book, which had been smuggled across the wall, and check out and see who was there. We had exquisite maps from the Russians, from the East Germans, plus our own maps, British survey maps. Photography was great. And then we had the military liaison mission, which was the Allied missions that actually drove in East Germany. The British had a version called Brixmix, the British mission. The French had one, but we had our mission, and we would do exchanges. We would send a non-commissioned officer over, and they would act as one of the observers or drivers with these cars, and we would be able to go out with these guys, and they would do their mission, and we would tag along and see what we needed to see. We could get ground photography out of the car, and it was the perfect method to do our early reconnaissance of a target.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and if you were in one of these teams that was going across the wall, did you knew what targets you were supposed to attack?
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
We did. Yeah.
Right. And so what, can you tell me what targets you were you in one of the teams that had to cross?
I was there on two different tours, and both times I had on each one I had a different target. On the first one, it was a series of bridges and railway interchanges that we were targeted to damage or destroy. And the second time around was a control facility at one of the Russian airfields. Completely different kind of way to approach the targets, but we had to get all the information from basically the beginning, how to get out of the city, get to the target, how to approach the target and actually eliminate it, and then hopefully be able to get out of the area. Quite frankly, our chances of survival were probably not very good.
That's an understatement, James.
Yeah. And our longevity wasn't real long either. The Supreme Allied Commander visited us at one time. It was General Rogers. And he basically said, what you guys are there for is to buy me time, to give the Allies in Western Europe the time to set up to meet and engage the enemy. And so our mission was to delay the Russians. Later on in the 80s, we were issued things like anti-materiel rifles, which I think are better known as the 50 caliber sniper rifle. The idea was to engage the Soviet strategic rocket forces behind the lines, the Scud missiles.
Like the SS-20.
SS-20s, the Scuds, everything. A single round in a Russian rocket would destroy it. If you penetrated the skin of the rocket, it was no good. And when you can shoot a target from 2 miles away, it's hard to defend against.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of, I mean, you know, I talked about you crossing the Berlin Wall, which probably makes it sound far easier than it would have been at the time. But how were you going to get over or under the wall? How did you plan that?
Well, each team was responsible for coming up with its own plan. I can't speak to those teams' plans because we didn't talk about them to each other. Everything was compartmented. But we had to come up with plans and then brief the commanders. And if the commander was satisfied, he let you continue with that plan. And then we would relook them every so often. You had to do a reconnaissance of not only the wall, you had to know exactly what was on the other side of the wall. And that's where we were relying on those reconnaissance assets, the overhead pitchers. The last thing you wanted to do was cross the wall and get happy and then find out that you were actually in an East German Army training area, which was very possible if you weren't watching what was going on. So we had to do a lot of reconnaissance. Getting across the wall was not that difficult. The hard part was getting away from it, and then becoming more or less invisible for the next part of the mission, which was moving from Berlin to wherever your target was.
Right, and that would have been on foot, I presume.
For the most part, yeah. And we would not move in large teams. We would break down into smaller groups of teams. Some would be in East German uniform. Others would move as civilian clothes. You're talking about moving men, equipment, radios, all the equipment necessary. So it's, yeah. Anyway,
so you did have East German army uniforms.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, we talked about it earlier that, you know, that the chances of surviving or getting back were not good. How did you feel about this basically being a suicide mission?
Well, I think I've written a couple of times that we didn't really think about it that much. I don't know whether we were being overly optimistic or we actually thought that we could make this happen. I think it was a combination of all the above. We were hoping we wouldn't have to go to war, obviously, but if it did come, we were prepared to take the chances, accept the odds, and try to do what we needed to do. We did not have a real sense that the enemy, the East Germans or the Russians, knew what we were going to do and where we were going to do it. So we felt that if we could clear the wall and get away from it, that our chances of success went up astronomically.
Right. Because, I mean, even if you're not killed, if you were captured and you're in East German uniform, then either the East Germans or the Soviets wouldn't take too kindly to that, would they?
No. And that was an accepted fact. That goes back to basically the start of Special Forces. One of the first commanders made it part of his of the agreement you would sign that would basically you understand that you may be out of uniform and this means you'll be in violation of the Geneva and the Hague Conventions and could easily be shot that way. And that was something that everyone accepted. So the moral of the story was don't get captured.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a big incentive. Big incentive
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about the Soviets and the East Germans. Were they aware that there were special forces in Berlin?
We always conjectured that they did know. In my subsequent research, when I wrote the book, the first time we show up in the East German Security Service files is about 1975. So that means the unit had been in existence for about 20 years before they figured out someone was there. The Russians claim that they knew, but they put the strength of the unit at about 800. So that was about 10 times our actual size. Our main worry was that they would get to us before we were able to go into action. So even if they knew where we were located, if in time of war we got away from that area quickly over the wall, then the chances of the Russians or the East Germans catching us were dramatically decreased.
Right. I also read that you were also trained to sort of set up escape and evasion networks for downed pilots. Is that correct?
There was... That was one of the implied missions that we were given. That would have been probably a long-term mission, obviously. And it would have been also fairly difficult to do. I have to say that a lot of the theories of working behind the lines were taken from our experiences in places like France and Yugoslavia, and the British had the same experience. What was, however, somewhat ignored or downplayed was the experiences that we had in the Ukraine and Albania, which were abject failures. So, if you sort of interpolate between the two, what an E&E network requires or an underground network requires is a populace that will support you. It's much more difficult in a total security state like East Germany. So we didn't expect a whole lot of help at the outset. If the war had gone long period, if we had survived for those period, then obviously you would have had a better chance of setting up some sort of an underground network, either for sabotage or for escape and evasion. But right off the bat, that would have been extremely difficult.
Yeah. And some of the exercises that you were involved in, I was fascinated in your book about Red Sail.
Began in the mid-1970s, and that was when we were beginning to get more and more involved in counterterrorism. And also, it was one of the key skills that put us into Iran during the Iran hostage crisis. But essentially, the British security institutes invited the Americans to send over some people to test their security. And it turned out that it was MI5 and MI6 primarily that were interested in this. But our unit was tasked because we had the mission of operating in civilian clothes in urban areas. And we began to send over small teams to run exercises in the southwest of England and test your security apparatus. And it was basically, we went over to basically mimic what an IRA terror cell would do in the UK. And the British organizers would give us specific objectives, and then we would try to carry them out. It ran the gamut from sabotage of a power plant to going in and doing a exfiltration of a prisoner outside of from a British police headquarters, things like that. So it was really a fascinating exercise for us. And that was back in the days when you could actually bake a file into a loaf of bread and bring it through customs.
I thought that was only in comics, James.
No, we actually did that. We actually brought in radios. We didn't carry weapons, but we brought in radios and other things that way.
Wow. Obviously, we've talked very extensively there about the wartime role that you had, but in peacetime, I understand you were working quite closely with military units like the SAS and the German GSG-9 as well.
That is true. We also had a good relationship with the German SEK in Berlin. Because Berlin was not part of federal Germany, so it was occupied Germany, essentially, German federal troops could not go into that area. So the German police had their special unit, which was essentially a corollary to the GSG-9 people. But we have always operated with Allied forces, Allied Special Operations Forces, and naturally the SAS was one of them. Germans were another one. And both through the Red Sails operations and through the heightened terrorist environment in the early 1970s, we began to work even closer with some of these units so that we could develop a counterterrorism capability of our own. And Berlin was actually the first army unit that was tasked with counterterrorism as one of its missions. And the Red Sails exercise was a very good demonstrator of how it's necessary to think and act like a terrorist if you're going to be able to counter them. And so that those kind of exercises were perfect for the unit. And we built up our clandestine skills, and then we built up our tactical hard skills. A lot of our shooting techniques came from the SAS, the close quarter battle techniques. We also worked with the Germans on taking down airplanes, although the Germans were working with the SAS for their Mogadishu operation. We did cross-training with the GSG-9 quite often.
Obviously, you wouldn't have been able to do all this training in Berlin, but did you do some training in Doughboy City?
We did do training in Doughboy City. We did training out in West Germany. Obviously, the heavier skills like explosives and things, if we were going to do some big stuff, we had to go outside the city. We did exercises in Western Germany, but we did have one really interesting opportunity in Berlin. The Lufthansa was not allowed to fly into Berlin at the time, so it was British Airways, Air France, and Pan Am at the time. Well, the Pan Am station manager in Berlin realized that aircraft hijacking was an issue. Came to the commander of Berlin and said, listen, this is sort of a area of concern for us, and I imagine it is for you. I said, if you have some people that would like to come out and play on our airplanes, I would be happy to facilitate that. So he set it up that we could go out to Tegel Airport and actually do practice runs on their airplanes at night off in one of the corners of the airfield. And then slowly we also got people into Pan Am uniform, and we were working on the active runways as Pan Am employees. So if you had flown into Tegel Airfield on a Pan Am airline, one of the ground crew guys that you saw unloading your bags might have been one of our people.
Wow. Wow. And I guess that gave you familiarization with that sort of role so that you could disguise yourself as baggage handler, you know, if there was a hijack situation, I suppose.
Very much so. We got to the point where the Pan Am ground crew people were teaching us how to basically taxi the airplanes. And obviously this was only for emergency purposes, but they gave us enough instruction on how to get into the airplane, how to turn on all the power, how to get access to everything underneath the airplane. We also found out, for example, ways to get into the cockpit through the baggage compartments on certain airplanes. We practiced it, full-on assaults on airplanes, opening doors, opening the windows over the wings, although the passengers on that flight the next day might have been somewhat uncomfortable had they known that little guys were punching through their windows the night before. So it was quite a unique experience, and quite valuable as far as the mission went. All our teams rotated through that type of training on an annual basis.
Yeah. Wow. Incredible stories. And I think now's probably a good time for us to come on to your book, because what you're doing here is not purely documenting the period that you were in Detachment A, but the history of U.S. Special Forces from 1956 to 1990.
That's correct. The unit gets together once a year, and as long as we're all still around, which is not going to be much longer, but at one of these little events, someone said, we ought to document our history because the Army isn't going to do it, and we're sort of disappearing off the face of Earth. And it was agreed to, and then someone mentioned the fact that I had written a book and said, oh, he can do it. And so I was sort of volunteered into it. But it became sort of a three-year odyssey for me. I interviewed quite a few of the original guys, the guys that came up in 1956, those that were around, some of the people that facilitated the startup of the unit, and went all the way through from 1956 to 1990. Talking to people, getting files together, finding out as much as I could, much information that was still there to write the story. The only real difficult part I had doing it, a few of the people said they didn't want to be interviewed because of their security requirements. And I agreed with them. I told them I was going to go through the proper security procedures, and then they promptly hung up on me. but that was a minor issue. One of the guys actually called back 6 months later and said, I hear you're writing a book. I wanted to be interviewed. But the most difficult part was getting it through the declassification process, because up to that point, nothing had been written on the unit. Nothing had been declassified. And I was told by several people that I could not write the book. I said, I understand how the system works, but one of the folks I talked to was a three-star general. He was the command of Army Special Operations at the time. And he said, I think it's a good idea. I wish you luck. And that was basically all the encouragement I needed. So I wrote the book and called up the Pentagon and said, hey, I've got this thing I would like you to look at. And they said, okay. 14 months later, it was approved for release. So that was the declassification process.
What I'd like to do is just pick out a few pieces from the book, because I sure. did find it interesting. And while some people might be interested in the latter part of the Cold War, covering it from 1956 does provide really useful context as to how these units were formed. But in there, you've got some great anecdotes. I think my favorite one, there was a unit doing some surveillance training, and they tagged a guy coming through Checkpoint Charlie. And they ended up in a cafe later. Can you just describe that one?
Well, that... As I mentioned before, Berlin was a focal point. I think Vienna and Berlin were two of the big focal points in Europe for espionage. But there were always something strange going on in the city. And this gentleman was in the unit in the early 60s and was doing some training with some of our friends from the States. And they decided they were going to watch the checkpoints where people crossed over from east to west. And they picked up a gentleman and began to follow him, a team full of, I think, five or six people, he said. And they spent most of the morning following this gentleman around. And at some point in the game, they realized that he was playing a game with them. And he would disappear, and then he would reappear in front of them, and they would follow him along. And finally, he went into a restaurant, And they decided, well, we've got to go see what he's doing. So they sent a couple of people into the restaurant and they sat at different tables. And before long, the gentleman they had been following got up and came over to one of the members of the surveillance team and said, I'd really like to talk to you guys. Would you come sit with me? And it turned out he never admitted which side he was with or who he was working for, but he proceeded to critique the people that were in the restaurant for a couple of minutes, and then they went outside and they practiced surveillance techniques with him being the instructor. So they went off at the end of the day, not knowing if they had been following an East German or a CIA agent or something else. But it was one of those just totally unique experiences.
I'd love to believe that the guy was from the Stasi.
At that time, yeah. I had a couple of incidents myself while we were doing some.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War. As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Doing a practice run downtown once, and I was watching a meeting between one of the guys in the units and another target. Let's put it that way. He was in a restaurant or an outside restaurant. And the restaurant was inside of an atrium, and there were several restaurants around. And I was off to the side trying to take pictures of our guy talking to one guy when I noticed another guy that was sitting in the middle of the atrium that had a briefcase next to him, and he kept very discreetly turning his briefcase sort of on an arc to cover a different restaurant. And I'm going, well, that's kind of odd. And then he turned it a little bit further, and I could see from where I was with my telephoto lens and my camera, I could see an aperture on his briefcase. This wasn't a guy that was from anybody I knew. It wasn't out of our unit. It was another guy surveilling a different meeting at a different restaurant. I took pictures of him and then turned them over to our local representatives. And they said, thank you very much, and shut the door in my face. And I never heard another thing about it. But I like to think that this guy was probably, he might have been a West German security guy. He might have been an East German Stasi officer. I never found out. But those kind of things happen all the time.
Well, the Berlin does have this moniker of City of Spies, and that story definitely illustrated that well. One of the other stories that I hadn't heard of was the trash can nukes. Can you just share a little bit about that?
We're going into sensitive territory, so I'll tell you what I can. In the late 1950s, the American Army decided that they needed a very powerful weapon to use on the ground as a way to deny an advancing force access to things like bridges. And basically what it was an adapted nuclear weapon. The original one was an adaptation of a nuclear bomb, a small one, and it came in three different pieces, would be assembled in the field. And the idea was that they would give it to combat engineer units who were trying to slow down the Russians, and they would be able to take this device, assemble it, and quickly put it under a bridge and destroy the bridge. That was a great way to knock something down quickly. It didn't require thousands of pounds of explosives, but naturally, it was a nuclear weapon. Well, before too long, somebody came up with the idea and said, well, if you can give it to the engineers, why not give it to the special operations folks to do similar things, but behind the lines? So a version of it was built and tested. The Navy underwater demolition teams, which later became the SEALs, were involved in the testing. But because of the classification of the weapon, which was above top secret, the only special forces unit that had people that were completely cleared to do it was the unit in Berlin. So they called on our unit to do some of the initial testing. This was 1956, 1957. And so we did actual tests, or the unit did actual tests by outfitting a team with a weapon, jumping it into Germany to hit a notional target in southern Germany, and then they were graded, of course, by the people that watched it, all to see whether or not it was feasible. It was feasible, and it eventually led to the development of a smaller nuclear device, which was called the Special Atomic Demolition Munition, which was probably the actual weapon that got the name Trash Can Nuke. The first weapon they tested was about 400 pounds total and required four people to carry it. The second weapon they developed was smaller, more efficient, smaller yield, but it only weighed 50 pounds and could be carried by one guy. That weapon remained in service for quite a while. It's only been, I think it was withdrawn from service in the mid-1980s.
Right, because I saw some photos of parachute drops with one of these sort of looked like dangling from the parachutist's leg.
Yeah. Well, when as far as the American way of jumping in, we strap all our equipment onto a lowering line harness that is carried underneath your reserve parachute when you jump, and then it is let loose so that it dangles below you about 30 feet. That way, when it hits the ground, you're behind it, and you don't have to try to land with an additional 100 pounds on your body. So that was the approved method for getting these things in. Anyway.
Yeah, it's just the thought of even having a small nuclear weapon dangling 30 feet below you and dropping by parachute must be quite an unnerving experience. One that you were probably glad that you didn't have to do in any of your training.
Yeah. I think the biggest question for the guys was whether or not the timer on the thing actually worked. Because a lot of guys would question this. So you want me to put this in for 10 minutes and then hit the button and leave? And it's not going to go off. And the guy would say, that's right. And I said, I'm not so sure I believe you.
Yeah.
Get rid of the witnesses. Same time.
Absolutely. That section on the Iranian hostage crisis is quite interesting because I was probably late teens when that happened. And I remember very vividly the news of the crash at Desert One, which was one of the landing points, and then the mission being aborted. But what I hadn't realized is there were some Detachment A guys still in Tehran.
That's correct. The first mission, the one that went bad, was called Eagle Claw. The subsequent mission, the second attempt that might have happened, was called Honey Badger. Our participation in the mission had a subset name, and it was called Storm Cloud. Very early on, the planners realized they had basically a conundrum because there were two targets within Tehran that had to be taken down. One was the embassy compound where about 66 Americans were being held, and a second location was the Ministry of Foreign Affairs where three more Americans were being held. So straight away, Delta Force, which was the stateside counterterrorism force, which had just been stood up and received its operational okay earlier that year. The commander of that unit said, "I have enough on my hands just worrying about the embassy." Whereupon my commander, who was in on the planning, said, "Well, we can handle the Ministry of Foreign Affairs." The reason why my commander was in that meeting was that the Army required better intelligence than what was available from the agency. And the Pentagon decided to put together a small team to send into Tehran. The first two guys that were sent in were Berlin Special Forces people with contrived passports, counterfeit passports, and covers that supported them as being businessmen. And they actually went into Tehran on several different occasions to collect intelligence. Their mission was also to put together the means to get the assault force from their second landing zone into the city. And that involves some coordination with an asset from the CIA who was able to acquire several large trucks and buses, which were hidden in a warehouse on the south edge of the city. As soon as the CIA guy got his part of the mission done, he left the country and it was turned over to our two guys, who were later joined by a third guy by the name of Dick Meadows, who was actually a civilian. He was former Special Forces, but he was working with Delta Force as an advisor. And he was chosen to go in as one of the additional people. So they were in the city when the force landed at Desert One, and they were actually sitting on top of a hilltop waiting for the helicopters that would have brought the forces forward to Tehran when they got the radio message that the mission had been aborted. They found out later in the morning that somebody in the Pentagon had made a mistake and said, "Oh, by the way, we have Americans who are collecting information inside Tehran." And that's when they realized that they were in real danger.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable that somebody releases that information. And, I mean, I am stunned by the bravery of you and your comrades in, you know, some of the missions, obviously, you can't talk about, but just being ready to do those missions is, it's beyond my comprehension anyway.
So some people would just question our sanity, one of them being my wife. But I would note that we're coming up very quickly. April 24th, 25th, 26th is the 40th anniversary of the attempt, the Iran rescue attempt. So
wow.
It's coming up soon. So.
Oh, okay. I found interesting what was probably almost your last operation, which is at the fall of the Berlin Wall, where the unit has changed name by this point because the press had discovered information, or somebody had released information to the press about the unit in the early 80s, I think it was. So
yes,
the unit,
that's correct.
So the unit's then renamed to the Physical Security Support Element, which is suitably anonymous. But when the wall falls, you're helping the Allied Refugee Operations Center, who were basically set up to sort of like filter refugees as they came through, and they were obviously overloaded when the wall opened, and so the unit's looking for what I would call persons of interest as they come across through the wall.
That's correct. They're basically scanning everybody that comes through, giving them a basic set of questions to answer to determine whether or not they might be of interest to the intelligence collectors. And most of the people that came across were basically East German citizens who were looking for a better life. And just wanted to keep going west. And but occasionally they would come across some interesting people. I think one of them was a senior officer in the East German Army who had access basically to not only all the telephone numbers of anybody and anyone who was important, but he had access to a lot of the training documentation for the East German military, which was, of course, very interesting to the military intelligence people and the CIA at the time. Very interesting time to be in the city, both to know that the wall is falling and then actually meeting some of these people that were on the other side, both the normal citizens. And one gentleman comes to mind was an elderly East German that came across all by himself and just happened to mention that he had spent the last number of years, 10 or 13, I believe, in prison. And it turned out that he had just been released, and he was of interest because he had been an asset. He had been a spy for the CIA and was arrested by the East Germans. So the CIA was, of course, very interested to meet with this guy and to help him out in his new life.
Wow. Wow. I hope he got his CIA pension then.
Yeah, I would sincerely hope so.
One bit I did like about that story is you said that the French were interested in a slightly different category of East German.
That was a very offhand statement, which I may have – I didn't embellish it, but it was the French were very interested in the younger females that came across, probably more so than the people of intelligence interests. So I think they were at the point where they said, well, the Soviet Union and the East Germans army is no longer a threat to us, and we'd rather see if any of these women are interesting or not. One would say that was typically French, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, let's not get in too much international stereotypes there. Were you in Berlin when the wall came down?
I was actually, I had been transferred out of the unit. I was in the United States. I had just joined with a new unit when a friend of mine called me and said, turn on the TV. And it was November 9th in the States. And I turned it on and saw, I think it was
Dan Rather
in front of the wall, exactly, and said, oh, that's interesting. I called up Pan Am, got a ticket that evening, and was in Berlin on the 11th, standing at the foot of the wall. You know, I went back over so that I could take part in it.
Wow. Wow. And that can you describe any of that experience?
Oh, it was just crazy. Of course, the East Germans were ecstatic, belying all the problems that lay ahead with the reunification. But I think at that point, nobody really understood what was happening. But going into East Germany, I had been there many times before, obviously, through my career. But going back over there now, and the government is basically coming apart at the seams. It's just a totally strange atmosphere. And I'm walking in one part of the city right in front of the Berlin Gate, and people are starting to sell stuff to get money. Western Germans and Americans and Brits are coming across to buy things, obviously, because it's a whole new economic paradigm. And I am looking at some things that people had set out, and one guy came up to me and said, would you be interested in buying some military equipment? And I said, well, I don't know. What do you got? And I said, well, I have a T-72 for sale. He was an East German Army officer who was trying to profit off of his tank battalion and said he could deliver it anywhere I wanted in East Germany.
I can imagine. I'm trying to imagine the looks as you drove that through checkpoint, Charlie.
It would have been interesting. I had to turn him down. I didn't have that much money. He probably sold it to somebody else. But
yeah.
It was a wild atmosphere, party atmosphere. I think that part of it would last for about 6 months until the reality of the world set in.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say was the best thing about being in Detachment A?
The best thing about Detachment A was, I think, beyond the camaraderie, which was incredible, it was probably the most unique unit in the U.S. Army from the 1950s to 1990s. It was definitely the most unique. It was sort of a hybrid unit between special forces and intelligence, sort of a modern day version of the Office of Strategic Services. Basically everything that I had imagined when I first saw that recruiting brochure my father brought home. It was a great place to be. Being in Berlin, in that, some people didn't like it. A lot of guys would come there and they wouldn't last for long because you were in sort of a, we had what we called wall fever because we were closed in a small space that was sort of oppressive. And you knew on the other side of the wall were a whole bunch of people that wanted to kill you. But being inside the city was, there's not a great deal to do. You couldn't go hunting and fishing very easily. A lot of the guys didn't like being in a city all the time. Myself, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was the atmosphere at the time was just, it was like being in a Le Carré novel almost.
Well, you were in a John Le Carré novel. And what would you say was the worst thing about being in Detachment A?
I'm thinking, which is interesting because I actually have to think on this one. I can think of one really bad moment, and this actually has to do with your forces, was 1979, Warren Point in Ireland, when the 2nd Parachute Regiment was ambushed and a number of two para guys were killed. I think 20 some British soldiers were killed.
There was a double explosion, wasn't there? There was an initial one, and then the IRA set off another one where they knew that people would take shelter.
And that was the same day that Lord Mountbatten was murdered. It was bad because Tupera had just come from a rotation in Berlin, and we managed to make a lot of friends in Tupera, and a number of them were lost that day. That's probably the worst. That was the worst experience I had there.
I've really enjoyed speaking with you. It's been a pleasure, but it has been an honor as well to speak to somebody who's been in a very select band of soldiers that have served in Detachment A. And I do recommend to my listeners your book. It's called Special Forces Berlin, Clandestine Cold War Operations of the U.S. Army's Elite, 1956 to 1990. There will be links to the book in the show notes, and we are also doing a listener giveaway. So make sure you check out the show notes for details of that. But James, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Ian, it's been a pleasure. I enjoy talking about the unit, as you can tell. Most importantly, the guys that I served with deserve all the credit. It was an amazing bunch of people to work with. My career in the military was great, but I count my service in Berlin and the people I met there as the highlight of my military career. And so being able to talk to you about it, being able to write of the history of this very unique unit that was filled with very strange, bizarre, wonderful people was an honor for me too. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Well, no, and I thank you and your comrades for their service as well.
Thanks, Ian.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.